This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 133, all about landscape photography. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm Jim Harmer. I'm your host, and I am joined by Jeff Harmon and Darren Meller and Nick Page. Welcome to the show, everybody.
Howdy.
Thank you.
We are all here to give you your weekly dose of photography knowledge, and a new voice this week is Majid. Majid is a landscape photographer and an awesome one at that. So we'll give you, make sure we have links to his work and stuff, and we'll kind of introduce you to him a little bit later. But Majid, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Today, we are going to talk all about landscape photography. We're going to dedicate the whole show to it. And so let's get started. Let's go with our first question. Somebody asks on the Q&A section of Improved Photography, I keep seeing movies. And Majid, I'm going to throw this one to you first. I'm going to toss you right under the bus. I keep seeing movies where people are using what looks to be like a rose-colored graduated neutral density filter on the sky of a landscape to make it look like a warm sunset, even when there's probably no sunset light. But I've never heard any photographers doing that. Why aren't photographers using colored filters? And is this something that I should do? What do you think?
Well, that's funny because it just reminds me of a filter that I used to own back when I started photography. Kokin used to make kind of these resin plasticky filters. And a lot of the neutral density filters tend to have kind of a color cast to them. And they used to be a lot more popular of an effect to add that color cast just by putting a filter on the front of the camera. Some of your neutral grad filters, even today, like Lee, will have a little bit of a color cast. Like my Lee neutral density filter has kind of a magenta cast. Have any of you noticed that?
I haven't noticed a magenta, but I've never definitely noticed kind of a I'd call it mocha, just kind of like a warm brown kind of color to a lot of filters.
Yeah, and it's just something that I think used to be more popular in photography, and I don't see it as much anymore.
Nick, do you use any colored filters?
I've done it in the past when using like flash photography. That way you can like color, put a gel on your flashes. Like, for example, you could put a green gel on your flashes, and then in theory, you could use a magenta gel on your, or a magenta filter on your lens, and that way you're canceling them out and thus making the ambient light like super crazy magenta. But I've never done it for landscape photography because it's just so easy to do.
Yeah, so I don't know, it's definitely something that people used to do a lot more. I think the reason that people don't do it as often now is that it looks cheesy when you do that. Yep, and you can do the exact same thing in Lightroom and make it not look cheesy. So I think that's kind of why this is kind of died out in the film days. You know, you could do some in post, but it sure made a lot more sense to just put a colored filter on there. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to throw this next one to you, Darren. 85 millimeter f1.2 lenses get such rave reviews for portraiture. Is it the optics or the field of view that's most desirable for that lens? Why is everybody crazy about the 85-1.2? And then this person's asking that they want to try that focal length of 85 millimeters, but they're on a crop sensor camera and they're not sure if they should, you know, still get an 85 because there's no 56 millimeter lens in the Nikon system. So the reason they're asking for a 56 millimeter lens is if you multiply the crop factor on a crop sensor camera like the D7100, it's going to give the same focal length as 85 millimeters on a full frame camera. So Darren, what say you? Is the 85 millimeter still a good lens for somebody on a crop sensor system?
I would say it's a heck of a sharp lens. I mean, when you look at the traditional prime lenses from the 35 to the 50 to the 85, those lenses, especially on the Canon and Nikon systems, they have thrown so much research and development into these lenses from the film days all the way currently to digital that you're getting a very, very sharp lens. And telephotos are getting much sharper to where this is becoming more of a moot point. But it used to be that telephotos were a hair less sharp because they had to have you know, different optics in there to accommodate the different focal lengths in there. But if you're looking for a true 85 millimeter on a crop sensor, you're going to definitely have to sacrifice the focal length, trade off on there. But if you want a heck of a sharp lens with really shallow depth of field with a beautiful bokeh, it's definitely a cool lens. I mean, you might have to back up a little bit with your feet, but that's kind of one of the trade-offs also for having a prime lens, is you're going to be zooming with your feet versus zooming with a telephoto of sorts.
Yeah, I don't know how we picked these focal lengths as photographers. Like, I don't know where some of this stuff comes from, that like 85 is the portrait focal length. I don't know. For me personally, I'd rather shoot around the 100 millimeter focal length on a full frame camera. I just like a little bit more zoom in there. In fact, I tested this. I was filming the beginner's class in a photography studio. I guess it was last week, and I'm working on editing the video now so we can get that out to everybody who's taken the beginner class. But I shot at 15 millimeters, 20 millimeters, 30, 40, 50, you know, all the focal lengths going up. And at 85 millimeters on a lot of lenses, there still isn't quite the feeling of compression to flatten out the features on the face. I kind of prefer that 100 millimeter focal length, honestly. So for me personally, I would rather use an 85 millimeter lens on a crop sensor camera than a full frame. Just me personally. I don't think you need to be searching around for this non-existent 56 millimeter prime on Nikon so you can get to this magic 85. The magic 85, I just don't see that one.
Yeah, but the other side of this is that shallow depth of field that you can get with that 1.2 aperture. Mm-hmm. I own the 85 1.8, and which is like a really good bang for your buck, because I think I spent $350 for it. The 85 1.2 for Canon version 2 is like a $2,000 lens, so it's an investment. But so I rented it, and the depth of field you get at 1.2 is like ridiculously shallow. It's like hard to use shallow. I'm a pretty good shooter, but I was struggling to get eyes sharp and struggling to keep my depth of field where I wanted it. But it's really good for getting that really, like, you know, dreamy, soft, silky look. Like, it's one of the only ways that you can do like a full body portrait and still have like this super shallow depth of field that kind of gives it that dreamy look.
Yeah, that's a very good point. The depth of field is really cool. But like on the lens finder that I'm putting a ton of hours into right now, I don't really recommend the f1.2 unless you're a pretty advanced shooter, because focus remains the number one thing that I see photographers struggling with. And so you get an f1.2 lens and you already had focus trouble. Holy cow. Are you going to have focus trouble? So I don't think you need to go crazy about it. I think an 85 is great for 99% of shooters. Get the 85 millimeter f1.8. It's way cheaper. It's still a great lens. It's going to be much easier to focus. Your depth of field is still very shallow. Or get a 100 millimeter lens, and you know, I'd have to work out the math here, but I've got to think, if we're at 100 millimeters rather than 85, and we jump to even f2, maybe f2.8 even, that the focal length, or that the depth of field, is going to be pretty similar to an 85, because the longer your focal length gets, if everything else is equal, also the shallower the depth of field. So a lot of factors there. I don't know if we need to split this into a crazy science. You know, if you're on a crop sensor camera, just get the 85-1.8 and call this a day, is what I'd say.
Yeah,
sounds good to me.
All right. Well, we want to talk a little bit about choosing the right tripod for landscape photography. Jeff, let me throw this one to you first. What are some of the things that you're looking for in a tripod?
So the weight is a big factor. I want to be able to go hiking in the mountains, and I don't want to be carrying a massively heavy tripod. And then being able to, of course, be sturdy enough that when I use it, it will hold the camera still. And that's really tough balance to get those two.
Yeah,
it usually means some money to get there. So I personally don't have that. I haven't invested heavily in the tripod yet. I took your advice a long time ago, Jim, and I have an Enduro tripod.
Those are great tripods. It's an aluminum or a carbon fiber?
I think I went aluminum.
Those suckers are heavy as anything, but right. That camera isn't going anywhere.
No, it's
They're
not.
They're not going anywhere.
Right. So
Enduro tripods are rocks.
I haven't invested in it yet. I'm going to be soon, because I'm going to be doing a lot of hiking this summer. And I want to take that tripod with me, but awesome. But it's been really good. And the price per to performance, like I've tried a number of cheaper tripods, they were all junk. And that Enduro is not much more expensive than the cheapy ones I tried. Uh-huh. And it is so much better. So if you're a hobbyist or you're looking to just like maybe take a little step forward on the tripods, the Enduro is awesome.
Yeah, they're very, very good tripods, and they'll last for many years. They're just heavy. That's the only problem with them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Majid, what's something you're looking for when you're looking at a tripod?
I think it's a really important piece of equipment for landscape photographer. It's actually, my opinion, probably just as important as the camera and the lens, the way you're stabilizing the camera for landscape photography specifically. Not as important for other types of photography. But I kind of beat the crap out of my tripods. So I'll take them into the ocean and they'll get salt water all over them. I'll take them across creeks. They'll be in the sand one day and then, you know, getting beat up all over the place. So just taking a tripod through all of that can really kind of break it down. And then another consideration for me when I purchased a tripod was, can the tripod get low enough? And a lot of tripods are designed with the center column, which...
So the center column's that pole right in the center that you can, you know, you extend the three legs and then there's a pole in the center that you can raise it higher.
And you never exactly. want to use it, even if you're out there, because yeah, it can be exactly. so much right. less stable.
You know, that really useless thing in the center that you never use or
that's on
use
every tripod that ever.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
Don't do it.
It's actually really difficult to find tripods that don't have it, which is right. unfortunate. I mean, it's marketed as a piece where, you know, you can get lower to the ground, but all the trouble to actually get your camera to the point and get that, you know, center column up to the point where you're actually on the ground, it was always a barrier for me. So when
are you talking about the ones where you can flip the center column to make it go upside down?
Yeah, that or you could even on my Manfrotto Lakes, the 055 XPROB.
XPROB, yeah.
Yeah, the XPROB, those lakes would, you could kind of lay that center column to the side and get right down on the ground.
Right. Okay, yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
Why is it tripods have to have terrible names?
They do have terrible names. True. And then there's the three-legged thing that names them all like human names, names them like Steve and Brian and stuff.
Which is genius. That's like the best thing ever.
It is genius. I haven't been a crazy fan of the three-legged thing stuff. A lot of people really love them, but it hasn't won me over.
Yeah, and for me, the main consideration was I need to be able to get low quickly. You know, things can change really fast in landscape. If you're shooting, there might be just a moment of light that passes really quickly. And if I want to make some object in the foreground bigger and I find a composition quickly and I have done a poor job scouting, which oftentimes is the case, then I've got to jump on a composition I see right away. So I ended up getting really right stuff tripod legs, and they the specific model was the BH 55 head with the TV34L legs, and
those are really pricey. They're like $1,000, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. They're very, very expensive. And it was a tough pill to swallow.
But the only trouble I have with the Really Right, I mean, I love Really Right stuff. They make awesome ball heads, and their tripods are going to last you forever. The only quibble I have with them is they're kind of heavy. Even the carbon fiber stuff. Like I talked to Really Right stuff a couple weeks ago, and I said, hey, I love this Faisal tripod. You know, I gave them the dimensions and everything. I said, what do you have that's similar to it? And they said, yeah, we just don't have anything that's that small and that lightweight. And to me, that made me feel pretty good about the Faisal. I just love the tripod I have.
Yeah, and I went through a few tripods, and basically there's kind of a video seminar that Miles Morgan, he's a landscape photographer out of the Pacific Northwest, he was talking to this group of photographers, and he said, you know, you can either buy one $200 tripod every couple years because it's going to break down on you, or you can just spend a little bit more money and get a quality tripod that's going to last you for a while. And that's kind of what I felt with the Really Right stuff at least so far.
And Darren, what do you think of the MiPhoto tripods that we see? Like 50% of the people on our workshops have those little MiPhoto tripods. What do you think of those?
I think they're pretty neat. I mean, they seem like they're sturdy. I think Erica K brought one out to Oregon, and that was one of the first times I've ever laid eyes on one, and they seem okay. I mean, I don't really mind having a heavier tripod. I was actually sitting off to the side doing 1,000 push-ups while you guys were talking about lighter tripods, but, you know, just building up my strength. But anyway, I don't mind an aluminum tripod. I shoot with the Manfrotto tripod that was on Amazon on around Christmas or Black Friday deal with a ball head, and it's fine for what I use it for. So I don't know. I don't mind lugging it up there. People call me crazy when I climb mountains carrying that and camera gear and a Camelback reservoir full of water, but I'd rather flex my muscles than have a light tripod.
There you
What's
go.
The weight of your tripod?
It's probably about maybe 7-8 pounds.
What about yours, Jim?
I can tell you in a couple seconds with the magic of Google.
I was gonna go look at mine too, because I don't know.
I don't know, but I shoot the Faisal CT3442. I've tried almost every tripod on the market, you know, either at a conference or I've bought one or you know, used one. You know, sometimes I'll borrow somebody's just to try different ones. I think I'm on my probably 8th or 9th tripod. I've owned a lot of tripods, and I've been through a ton. And this one I just absolutely love. This one weighs 2.4 pounds, 1.1 kilos. Nice. So it's super, super lightweight. And it's also very compact. Sometimes in my photo bag, it's compact enough I can slip it in the bag. You know, I don't even have to have it on the side or on the back. It just fits in the bag itself. So I really like that. And it's only 3 leg extensions, but it comes up to the perfect height for me. You know, everybody's a different height, but you know, I'm an average height for a guy, and it just comes right up to my eye with even a smaller ball head. So I like that it's a comfortable height for when I'm standing straight up, but I mean, I can put this literally flat as a pancake on the ground because there's no center column. I like there are three, you know, those tourney locks. By having only 3 extensions on each leg instead of 4, you can't get quite as compact, even though this is a pretty compact head or pretty compact tripod, but it takes less time to set up. The four extension ones, it just take a little bit too long to set up for my personal mm-hmm. preference. The other thing I like about this one is you can close the legs. You can rotate them up over the head, which makes it even a tiny bit more compact. Just a lot to like in it. Mostly it's so light and so small. It's just been great for me.
So the Enduro I have is only a pound heavier than that. It's 3.6 pounds.
Oh, that's great.
And I know everybody's so excited about really light tripods, but you guys haven't had your tripod blow over like I did and with a 5D Mark III and then have to send your lens in. So and that was with my, I've got one of the big Enduro aluminum ones. I don't know all the letters and numbers, whatever. One of the bigger ones.
And you had one of those Enduro aluminum tripods blow over.
That's
crazy. Did you have it set up right? That doesn't even seem possible.
I had it set up high though. So like that kind of increased it totally set up normal. It's not like I had the feet really close together or anything, but that kind of convinced me that I'd rather suffer the consequences of packing the heavy thing on my hikes than have that happen again, you know, because I can't imagine how much easier a carbon fiber tripod would blow over.
I've been using them for years. I've never had it blow over or even come close.
It's windy over here in Eastern Washington. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It doesn't help when you're on a really tall vista and it's like, you know, it was probably a solid 35, 40 mile an hour gust. So it wasn't like, you know, a light breeze or anything, but still that experience convinced me to just stick with heavy tripods. And
wait. So think about the logic. My tripod blew over. I'm sure I want to keep this tripod. What is happening over there?
Next time I will have it lower to the ground. maybe the whole problem was I wasn't standing anywhere near it. I was just sitting in the car and heard a thunk and go out, and my lens is broken in half. My 5D Mark III is like laying on gravel with no lens on it. It was a terrible sight.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. So heavy tripods for Nick. I'm just, a big, strong guy. I can do it.
Just for the listeners, my tripod, the Really Right Stuff tripod, is about 7 pounds, roughly.
Holy
cow. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's a little bit heavy.
But that's more than 3 of my tripods.
But it's a 4-section tripod, and I'm 6'4". And I can stand under it when it's fully extended. So
doubles is like tall. A tent frame.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
We call it the teepee tripod.
Put a poncho on it and you have a nice sail.
Oh my.
He creates blinds with it when he's shooting wild.
Times are tough. That's how I do all my fine art fairs. So
no, that's good. There are some of those aluminum enduros that also get really, really tall. And, you know, it's kind of funny because you say, am I ever going to need that for? You know, when I was using those tripods, sometimes it really is pretty nice to just get a really high perspective. There are quite a few times that I got some interesting shots just from being above where normal people's eye height is. And Majid probably looks at it and it's like, no, I see that perspective every day.
Right. Well, and not to mention, like, if you have a couple of your tripod legs down in a river or something, sometimes those long legs come in handy. Sure. Because yeah, they can actually, you can keep your camera above water, which is useful. Yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, we want to get on to talk about the 5-minute segments of the week and our doodads of the week. But before we do that, we want to thank two people who have made the Improved Photography Podcast possible. First is Art Mill. Art Mill makes absolutely gorgeous prints. They have 8 different modern alternatives to having the regular old print with, you know, regular old traditional framing. So not paying for the framing is really, really nice. And they have just really interesting mounting styles that you can do with your prints. They print even up to huge 60 inches by 120 inches. That is a massive print. You just upload your photo, select your style, pick your size, and check out. You don't have to download any weird software. You don't have any weird stuff that a lot of the print companies make you do. Very, very easy to order. And they do beautiful. My favorite is the acrylic prints that they do. They just look so good. The colors look fantastic. You can get started for as cheap as $16. You can get your prints made. So visit artmill.com/improvephotography, the full name. artmill.com/improvephotography. And that's going to get you 25% off your first order. If you want a really high quality art, fine art print, Art Mill is the place to go. artmill.com/improvephotography, and that'll give you 25% off your first order. And we thank them for their support of the podcast. And also by Harry's. Harry's is the best way to take care of shaving problems. I have always used razors that you try to make them last as long as possible because they're worth like their weight in gold. You don't have to pay $32 for an 8-pack of blades anymore. At Harry's, you can sign up. Everything's taken care of for you. You don't have any more, you know, poor quality blades or plexiglass cabinets to unlock. They make everything beautiful. It comes in a beautiful box branded for you. The blades are made in Germany. It's just a really, really high quality shaving experience. And you can get a promo. The starter set is an amazing deal. $15 to get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades. And with promo code IMPROVE, you get $5 off that for an amazing deal. So $5 off. What is already a good deal at $15. You can go to harrys.com and Harry's will give you $5 off when you type in the coupon code IMPROVE with your first purchase. Just IMPROVE. So go to harrys.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout. And we thank them for their support of the podcast as well. Well, we want to jump into our 5-minute segments of the week. And I'm going to toss the first one over to Jeff Harmon.
All right, so for mine, I wanted to talk about the project I have going on this summer, and that's that I'm testing out a whole bunch of hiking backpacks for camera gear.
Oh, that is awesome.
So I've got a whole bunch of manufacturers, different kinds that I'm going to be taking out and actually putting through the test. So it's not like checking them out in my living room and saying which one I like the best. I'm going to go put them out there in the wilderness, and we're going to see how they hold up.
How many bags are you testing?
So I have 5 right now. I'm working on getting a few more before the end of the summer that we'll see how many I end up with. But 5 different kinds right now.
That's awesome. That's really good to be able to see so many bags to really see
right.
the pros and cons of each one, because just about everybody's using the backpack style camera bag, I think. I mean, most shooters, that's what we're doing. So that's a really helpful test. So what are some of the things you've noticed so far?
So I took one out on scout camp. So I just last week I wasn't on the podcast because I went and was spending a bunch of time with 12 and 13 year old boys out in the wilderness.
And they don't smell any better when they're away from home.
No. It's like a contest to see who can remain the dirtiest all week. But but I took it there, and it was a really good test of the bag. So I took out it's called a Think Tank Streetwalker Pro. The bag held up really, really well. I was very impressed with the quality, really high quality. The zippers are like butter. They're very smooth. They were great. Oh yeah, they're good. I liked how you could detach the tripod too. It has a very solid mount for the tripod. The complaint I have is the whole setup is really kind of a destination sort of backpack. You're not going to be wanting to like take it off and set up at multiple places along the way. It's more like, hey, I have a 5 mile hike I'm going to go do and get to the peak of somewhere. This is a great bag for that. You pack it up, you get it. It's going to keep it nice and secure and safe and ready to go when you get to your destination. Then you unbundle it. Not that it would be too bad to stop along the way, but it's certainly not going to be one where you like sling it around your shoulder and get your gear out and take a picture real quick and then sling it back. It doesn't work. It's not designed like that.
What do you think about the looks of it? I mean, this is a bag that kind of screams, this is a camera bag to me.
It does.
Is that the impression
you
got?
It really does. Oh, yeah. And the other complaint I had about it was the bag itself. I mean, it has plenty of room for the gear. I could take everything and a bunch more that I had with me or that I wanted to take on a trip. But boy, when I put it on, it felt like I was wearing like a little kid's backpack. It's kind of small where it is. I could adjust the straps and it would fit fine. I'm not a small guy, so it fit okay, but it just felt like I had a cartoon backpack on the back.
You mean the footprint of the bag or that the waist belt was like at your belly button or what?
No. Just the bag itself. It's just not very tall, I guess. It felt a little funny. But I mean, it fit fine. The straps fit okay, but it felt a little funny on my back.
Okay.
It was really, like I said, really great to be able to carry it there. The tripod holder I liked because it holds it so securely, but it also means you can't actually get to the gear inside the bag without taking the tripod off.
Oh. Yeah, that's a negative.
Yeah. So again, like I said, it's really kind of designed for a destination. You've got a ways to go that you're hiking with this bag. And when you get there, you're going to take your gear out.
I see this more as an airport kind of bag than a hiking bag. Is that fair to say?
Maybe so. It has great padding to protect your gear. It survived really well with all of that. It protected my gear great. It didn't even let the dirt inside. So I was in a very dusty, dirty area, tent camping. This was, wilderness, and it's like perfectly clean inside. It's really good that way.
Yeah, Think Tank uses the highest quality of everything on all their bags, like no compromises in terms of quality. Yep. It may not be the perfect size or whatever, but in terms of materials, they are good stuff.
Yep. So it was good. I mean, overall, I think I had a good experience with it. If I was doing that destination sort of hiking, this is a great bag.
Cool. Nick?
So this week I've actually had the luxury or the misfortune, depending on how you look at it. We have some wildfires going through our area. And so I've been photographing pretty extreme wildfires rolling through the area. And it's a first for me, for sure. And I guess I wanted to reflect a little bit on that whole subject. It's kind of an interesting thing to be out photographing this amazing fire and to feel so torn about photographing it. The first night that we were out there, I was set up and I had another photographer friend there and we were photographing it. And every time a big tree would go up, like we would ooh and ah, and you say, oh man, that's so cool. And then there was a couple other people standing there. And eventually one of the guys came over and he was like, you could be a little bit more respectful because our cabin's right there. And I'm like, ooh. Ouch. Okay. Yeah. That's a fair point. And so I learned the importance of being respectful in that situation. So that's one of those things to keep in mind if you're out actually photographing a wildfire or something. It was actually about a month ago that we had a house fire here in town, and we had two giant two-story houses go up, and I was photographing those, and afterwards I had posted the pictures online, and it was amazing to me how controversial it was to post photos of a house fire. Because, you know, most people are like, oh, these are amazing pictures, it's so sad. And then there was somebody had actually sent me some hate messages about how paparazzi-ish it was, and how, you know, it was like me trying to, because I had put my watermark on it, they said that I was trying to market my business off of the misfortune of others. And I found that really interesting. So I've had all these torn feelings about, like, it's a very exciting thing to photograph, but at the same time, you have to be in a very respectful place. Have you guys shot any kind of house fires or wildfires or anything like disaster-ish like that?
I shot a fire once that had kind of broken out in a neighborhood. And, you know, it's interesting. I don't know. I just don't see the problem with that, honestly. Maybe if you're making like cutesy art about it, you know, and you know, somebody's dying in a fire, that's kind of maybe not so cool. But, you know, it's news, and news should be photographed because it's, you know, going to let other people know what's happening. And so I just don't see a problem with that, honestly.
Exactly. And that would. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
I live in a place in Utah where the military does training a lot, and they light up the hill all the time. It's almost a yearly thing that the same hill goes up in flames every year. And so I've done it a lot too, but mainly because the colors you get when sunset happens are just like so different with all that smoke in the air and the fire around.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Like right now we have no clouds, but we have all this smoke, and is almost as good for a sunset.
Yeah.
But so a few of the things that I learned through all of this was, first of all, obviously be respectful. And second of all, be safe, because when you're out like where the wildfires are happening, it's in the foothills of our mountains. So you have to drive up on these ridges, which are these long, windy dirt and gravel roads. You have to be up on top of a ridge just to see the next one. And the first night we were actually in the path of the fire, which is super smart. And so we were one ridge over and ahead, but we had to keep an eye out and make sure that there was no embers starting fires like back down the road from where we had to go. So that's, being safe is kind of one of those priorities when you're shooting stuff like this. And another thing is to be the first to post the photos online. Because of the photos I took in the last 3 days, I've received, I don't know, like probably 50 friend requests, like in 2 or 3 days, just from these fires. And because I'm supplying all these photos of the news and this really timely story, everybody has just flooded my page. One of my posts received almost 300 shares. And you know, hundreds of likes. So my work is getting all kinds of attention and eyeballs. So it's positive in that respect, but you definitely have to be respectful. You got to be safe. And yeah, that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. Another thing I learned was how difficult it is to use long lenses in a windy and dark situation, because I had actually rented the Sigma 150 to 600. And so I was trying to use that like after dark, and it was so windy. You can't use a long shutter speed because, for one thing, you lose all the detail and the smoke and the fire. But for another thing, the wind was just like wreaking havoc on my image. Like 600 millimeters just looks really, really poopy when the wind blows it around. So yeah, that's some of the things that I learned this week.
Very good. So yeah, on the vein of cashing in on disasters, Petapixel posted an article this last week about some ridiculous senator in California. Oh wait, all of them are. how did that happen? anyway, a senator in California who had proposed a bill to make it legal for firefighters to shoot down drones. You know, people who are doing photography of fires using drones when there's a fire like that. because they said there have been a few instances where the drones have gotten in the way of them fighting in the fire. Now, this kind of thing makes me so annoyed as an attorney, because the only reason that people are proposing bills like this is to get attention. That's why they want to do it. They want to get in the news. The senator does. Because guess what? Firefighters can already do that. If your car's parked in front of the fire hydrant, do you think they're going to say, oh, shoot, we can't fight the fire? No, they're going to smash your windows and they're going to stick it through, because it's necessary to fight the fire. They can already do that. You don't need a special bill about shooting down a dumb drone that's in the way if they're trying to fight a wildfire. That's the only reason they do this. Why do you think we see legislation about texting while driving? We don't need laws about texting while driving. It's just so some stupid senator can get in the news after somebody died from a texting while driving accident. You can already prosecute the person criminally. You can already prosecute the person civilly just because they were driving distracted. They were negligent. And so this is already taken care of. You don't need some kind of special law because they had their phone out. It's the same as if they were, you know, turned around not looking at the road and they were negligent that way. It's already taken care of. Senators do this stuff because they want to get in the news. So look, we fell prey and we mentioned them on the podcast. All right, Majid, what's your 5-minute segment?
All right. So basically when I'm around waterfall, the ocean, lake streams, that type of thing, there's really opportunities to get some unique perspectives. But that actually requires getting into the water. And sometimes it may seem like it's not worth it to do it. You know, you don't want to get your clothes wet and that type of thing. But
so you're like actually wading into the water with your tripod and setting it up in the water?
Absolutely. I've actually owned a pair of fishing waders just so I can get deeper into water for perspectives. You know, your pants are going to dry, your shoes are going to dry, but a photo you get with a unique perspective, that's going to last forever. So on the same note of shooting water, I think one of the things that maybe some people who are new to photography, they drag the shutter maybe a little too long. And once you get past a certain point when you're photographing water with a long exposure, you're going to start to lose some of the detail in the water. So what characterizes the speed and the texture of that body of water? An ideal range really is just to experiment. So if you're at like the ocean and you're shooting crashing waves, well, maybe in that particular situation, you want to freeze the wave. So you're going to be at 1/400th of a second. Maybe you're going to be trying to slow down water receding into the ocean. So getting kind of a leading line, a slow shutter speed. So maybe in that case, you'd be in the range of 1/8 of a second to a second. I think a general rule for me is I try not to go over about a half a second to a second, depending on how fast the water's moving. Otherwise, you're going to start to get kind of that misty look. You're going to get that milky look on waterfalls and that type of thing and really lose a lot of the textures. But you can really use shutter speeds in landscape to bring your viewer into your image and getting that low perspective. Yeah, just go for it. Just get in the water. You know, but be safe, of course. If there's 12-foot waves, you're probably not going to want to go right out into the ocean. You know, go in and get the unique perspective.
Very cool.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And that's kind of where my segment leads to, is going back to the roots of what you really love to shoot. What made you pick up your camera is really what you should possibly be shooting. Even if you've tried different things, I always tell people when they first get into photography, don't be afraid to branch out and shoot portrait photography. Don't be afraid to go out and shoot wildlife photography, shoot street photography, shoot whatever you seem like you're going to fall in love with. But don't get stuck shooting something that you're not really passionate about. And I've been shooting a ton of portraits. I'm actually a co-host, as everyone knows, of the Portrait Session podcast, and I've been doing a ton of portraits lately, but I found out that quality is a lot better than quantity. And I've really kind of burnt out by doing so much quantity of portraits. So my plan for 2016 is to shoot more street photography, because I really enjoy telling other people's stories through my lens and just capturing that one moment in time, like I was able to identify with when we were in Chicago. I actually want to get into journalistic photography, maybe travel to some conflict zones, do some news type photography over there, just to kind of give back and tell the story of that's what's going on over there. I'm going to stay away from Syria and Iraq and areas like that because I don't want to be kidnapped or anything. But also maybe see if I can talk to Mr. Brian McGuckin and see if he has any connections for doing travel photography. Because when I travel and I explore new things, it just makes me feel invigorated and it makes me feel like I'm young again. I'm only 29 and a half and I'm sounding like I'm 60 years old by making that statement. But, you know, when it comes down to it, I want to shoot what I love. I don't want to sit around and say, yeah, I don't want to take my camera out today. And I'm not going to use the Jim Harmer excuse that my camera's too heavy. I'm just going to say that I'm just shooting the wrong thing. So I think that I need to get back to my roots of shooting what I'm passionate about. And that's really my 5 minutes this week is go back to what you really picked up your camera for. Go back to what made you decide to listen to our podcast the first time to learn about photography and made you really thirsty to learn more about the craft. And I think that'll really make your photography shooting experience that much better.
Very good. I like that. Well, speaking of that, that's exactly what I want to talk about. So I mentioned in the podcast, well, the last couple of weeks about first trying the Fuji and then eventually switching to the Fuji and deciding to sell my Nikon gear. And then this week, I really, you know, I put my money where my mouth is, literally, because I boxed up everything that I own. I mean, just about every piece of photo gear I own, I boxed up and I posted on Improved Photography. I listed everything out and I just posted it for sale at ridiculously good deals. I know a lot of you have purchased items this week from me of my lightly used and some of it not even used at all photo gear and sold it from Improved Photography. Just there was, I put a post right on the website. I hope you didn't miss it. It was awesome. And so I spent the entire day in my office, which is just an old spare bedroom in our house upstairs. And I just spent all day boxing everything together and shipping it out. And I took everything that I, you know, really loved and I wanted to keep, you know, a camera, whatever lens I liked. I kept my tripod because I love that. You know, just I picked, you know, the things that I love and I definitely want to keep. And everything else is gonzo. A lot of it is great, great gear. But the big thing for me is I wanted to cut weight and still get the exact same quality experience from the gear that I have been using. And so I did it. I got rid of as many camera bags as I could. I'm trying some new stuff because I think it's important for me to not get too stuck in a rut using the exact same gear all the time because, you know, that's what I do full time is tell you guys about photo gear and write on Improved Photography and talk photography. And so I want to know that I have the very best stuff to recommend to others to save you the money of buying 10 things and buying it wrong. So my main goal has been saving weight, but getting the same quality. And so I got rid of a huge amount of stuff. And let me tell you what, I am so excited to get out and take photos. And now that I can just have one go bag every single time, it's just right next to my desk. Now I have one camera backpack that holds all the gear that I need to, tripods in there, has batteries in there. So, you know, if we're going on a family camping trip, just going out with the kids for the day, going on a little family hike, it's always ready to go. I don't have to like pack a special bag to be ready. And so it's making me shoot a lot more by having that bag just ready to go all the time. So I guess my tip for today is to get in a place where you have gear that is easy for you to use, whatever that means. For me, it was cutting out the weight and having a bag ready to go. But I think once you do it, if you're feeling a little bit stagnant with your photography, that is a really good way to get reinvigorated. Well, we want to talk about the doodads of the week. And I have a bunch of that I want to share for this week. But before we do that, I want to remind you about our workshop in China next year. So if you haven't signed up for the workshop, you've got to look at your 2016 and just think, you know what? You're going to be stuck in an office all day, every day, working, doing whatever it is you do. You know, do something for yourself. And if you can make it this trip, I promise you will not regret this trip. I mean, we have the best guides in China that get us to the very best location. Like, you want to shoot the cormorant fisherman, you've seen awesome photos of the cormorant fisherman, maybe some photos that we've shared from the last time that Darren and I were there. You don't go there just one time and you get one crack at it. We'll be there two and three times and we'll get the very best cormorant fisherman all dressed up, and we get them in the exact right spot with cool looking mountains behind them at the exact right time of day, and you'll get multiple tries at each shoot. You know, we'll go to the cormorant fishermen's homes and we'll, you know, meet them and their wives, see what it's like, and shoot environmental portraits there. We're traveling all over the country, shooting landscapes with these incredible mountains, street photography, portrait photography. I mean, you get a taste of everything, and top notch, world-class instructors for the whole thing. I mean, you got Brian McGuckin's going to be there. Erica Kay is going to be there. The amazing Nick Page is going to be there. I'm going to be there. I mean, you're going to have everything you need to make this the trip of your life. So check it out, improvephotography.com/China. That's improvephotography.com/China. Read through the details and seriously think if there's any way you can get there. I promise you will not regret it. And also, we are starting a Facebook group for this podcast. Now, we have our Facebook page. That's, you know, the Improved Photography Facebook page. We have over 500,000 people on there. But this is a group. And this, you know, this is like the kids in the back of the class that we make stupid little remarks. This is where you can, you know, when you get a new camera and you're testing something out, you can do it. I mention often on the podcast our little Facebook Messenger group that, you know, Darren and Jeff and Nick and I will always just be kind of messaging photo nerdy stuff back and forth during the week as we're testing out new stuff. We're going to move that discussion out so that we can have it with all of you. And so that's in a Facebook group. So you can post to us, we can post to you. I mean, it's a community and it'll show up right in your Facebook feed. So just go to Facebook and search Improved Photography Podcast and you'll see it. Or if you don't see it for whatever, Facebook search is notoriously horrible, go to improvephotography.com/improvephotography podcast Facebook. Woohoo! That's a big link. Improved Photography Podcast Facebook, and you'll get it right there. But if you just search Improved Photography Podcast on Facebook, it really should just show up for you. So, you know, come in there. We can chat more there and you can get to know us a little bit more. We'll have, you'll be able to converse with us there. Okay, time for the doodad of the week. I've been talking too much, so I'm going to toss the first one right over to Nick.
So my new favorite lens currently is the Rokinon 24mm f1.4. This is a manual focus lens. It's a manual aperture lens, but that makes it super cheap.
Talk about manual aperture. So manual focus means you got to actually twist the little thing until it's in focus. Tell us about manual aperture.
Right. How archaic is that? You can't, the camera doesn't do it for you, but
and the same is turn your wrist. It's awful.
And sounds like Darren's kind of lens. Fill up those muscles.
So for those of you that have ever seen these film cameras, they used to have these things called film cameras, and on these things called film cameras were lenses, and on the lenses you would have your focus ring, your zoom ring, and your aperture ring,
like, and my Fuji has, and it's awesome.
Exactly. And so this Rokinon, you know, you change your aperture right on the lens. It's just got the dial, and so yeah, it's a manual aperture lens. Fairly self-explanatory, but so
it's got a ring that you turn to change the aperture.
Exactly. You just turn it and it changes the aperture. So the reason I like this lens so much is because it's amazing for night photography and stars. I've tried out the Canon 24mm 1.4, which is like a $2,000 lens. And this Rokinon, which is like a $350 lens, outperforms it in the way of not having weird, crazy distortions in a circular pattern with your stars. So the Canon lens, it actually it had, what is it, chroma or coma distortions? Coma distortions. And and it's essentially, it makes the stars in the edges of the frame look like little UFOs moving in a circular pattern. Super distracting. It's really ugly. But the Rokinon doesn't have any of that. So it makes it awesome for night photography, because f1.4, you can soak in so much light, and because it's 24 millimeters instead of the 16 millimeters that I'm used to shooting it at, you're only, like, for Milky Way photography, you're only pointing your lens at like the meat of the Milky Way. It's the absolute best part of the Milky Way. So it's my new favorite lens. It's awesome for night photography. It's also really cool for video. For those people that shoot a little bit of video, having that really shallow depth of field and a wide angle is pretty cool. So that's my doodad of the week. It's the Rokinon 24 millimeter.
Excellent recommendation. I just bought a 16 millimeter f1.4, which with the crop factor is a 24 millimeter f1.4 nice. In the Fuji system. I just got it in the mail today and it looks beautiful and it has an aperture ring. The other thing I like about it is it has the little focus meter on it. Does the Rokinon 24 have a focus meter so you can see when you're at infinity?
Yes, it does, but it's not accurate.
It's off.
It's off.
They all are.
Super not. But since
you can hope that it's on because it's a prime. Like it should be on a prime. I get it with a zoom why it may not be right. Just right with the focus breathing, but with a prime, it should be on.
Yeah, but it's Rokinon. Yeah. You know?
Okay. Let's be honest here.
I'm just doing good for it to like, you know, actually focus at all. But so does this mean, Jim, that you're actually going to take me up on this low light competition?
I specifically bought this lens for that. I promise. Whoa. I did. And right. When we go to Utah, I think we should both, you know, we'll get out there, have a couple nights, shoot some night photography. We'll, without telling who shot which one, we'll post them both up to our new Improved Photography podcast Facebook group, and we'll let the good people of the internet decide which is better. Loser buys dinner.
You're on. It's a deal.
You'll rue this day. All right, Jeff, what's your doodad?
All right, so mine is going to be something I used at this camp that I went on. So I brought my iPhone. We were not quite remote enough that I still did have some service. It's getting better all the time. But I wanted to be able to charge my phone. I wanted to use it for photos along with my camera, kind of mix and match, do them both, maybe share some things on Facebook with people back home while we were out. Anyway, I wanted to charge it. There's no electricity where we're at, so I needed to bring something with me. And what I ended up, I've had something for a while now and it just worked so well again. I decided I'd want to recommend it here. It's an external battery pack from Anker, A-N-K-E-R. And it's called the XT Power and it's a 10,000 milliamp external battery pack. It has two USB ports so you could charge two things at once. Charge anything USB that you wanted as long as you know, until you suck the battery dry. And it charged my iPhone 6 Plus 4 times, plus my Fitbit watch 1 time while I was camping. So it's just a really great way to be able to keep stuff charged up. There's actually a new one. And another good thing is it's $50. So it's a very reasonable price for a really good battery pack. There's a newer version of it that is 3 times the power. It's the XT Power MP32000. And it's $130. But it's even, they're saying that you could even use it to charge your laptop if you were out in the middle of nowhere and needed to kind of top it off or keep it running for a while. It also has an output port so that you could connect a wire to power your DSLR or your camera. There's a different attachments that you could get so that it could potentially hook up to your camera and keep it running.
Ah, so very cool.
I like those.
Yeah, that's great. I wish more cameras would allow for USB charging. That'd be great. Darren?
Mine is the Facebook Groups app. I don't know why Facebook, whenever they release an app, it has like 2 or 3 stars. I downloaded it right away, and I don't know if anyone else has it on their phone yet, but just short and sweet, it has a visual representation of what is going on in Facebook Groups. So no longer is your Facebook app on your phone just populating with 10,000 notifications if it's something being posted in a group. It all goes over to the Facebook Group app, and you get a visual representation of which group has activity, and it helps you manage groups that you're an admin on, and it also helps you manage what's going on in other groups that you're involved in. So check it out. It's probably available for all mobile platforms.
Oh, that's cool.
Used it much, Darren?
Yeah, I love it. It even has its own dinging sound that's different from Facebook, so you can tell that, yep, that's a Facebook group app notification.
All right, I'm downloading it. And
I got
when
I got it the second it was released. And the thing I didn't like about it for a while was yeah, it has the nice little notifications about new messages in your group. It didn't seem to clear it from the Facebook app itself.
Oh, it does now. It's good. I like it.
Oh, good. Okay, I'll have to give that a better try then.
Yeah, I'm downloading. So whenever you guys post in our new Facebook group, just know there's a little ding in Jim Harmer's pocket right now.
You're going to rue the day.
Majid?
All right. So I have an app that I like to use. Are there any storm chasers here?
Nick?
Me. Me.
Nick?
Me.
Okay. So I'm not really like, somebody who's going to, you know, drive 15 hours and chase the storm cell. But when I'm out on a trip anyway, and there's lightning activity or thunderstorm activity, then it can make really interesting subject because of the dramatic weather. And there's an app for iPhone called Lightning Cast. Any of you use it?
No.
It's a really cool app, and it's actually a subscription model. So you pay like $2 or something. And the first time I used it, I was actually up at Crater Lake National Park in Oregon, and was just up there kind of by myself. A storm cell was basically forming over the lake, and very, very poor service up there, but just enough service to push the data for lightning cast. So I would see a bolt of lightning, and then the notification on my phone was the sound of thunder. So I'd be hearing the sound of thunder on my phone while I was hearing the sound of thunder bounce off the canyon walls, the high sheer faces of Crater Lake, pretty much simultaneously. So it was really amazing. Wow. It works really well. It pinpoints the exact geo coordinate of the lightning strike. I'm not quite sure how it works, but it seems to work really well. So you get push notifications to your phone. You can see where there's storm activity. When I was up in the Palouse area and up in Nick's neck of the woods, I used it extensively to chase some storm cells that were happening over there. It's called Lightning Cast. I think it's a couple bucks for 3 months. It's well worth it, if especially now we're in summer and it's thunderstorm season.
Dude, I'm so
very cool.
It's awesome.
Well, Majid, it was great to have you on the podcast. Where can we catch up with you online?
My website is www.majidb.com. I'll spell that out. It's MajeedB.com. And cool. I'm on Facebook and all the other places.
Awesome. Are you on Instagram?
I am, yes.
Okay. I'll have to follow you there.
Just my full name. So Majid Batazadigan. So if you just start,
I better spell that.
Yeah, so
one.
No problem. Yeah, got it.
So if you just put in Majid in the search, you should see me somewhere on there. I don't expect you guys to know how to spell my last name. So,
all right. Well,
not yet, at least.
We'll hook up. We'll get on there. And you can follow me at Jim Harmer on Instagram as well. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us on the podcast, and we will see you in another 7 days.